The Gamer's Haven at gamershavenpodcast.com and Vorpal Network at vorpalnetwork.com are proud to present coverage of Gen Con 2010.
It's game time.
Quiet, please. I am analyzing.
The Gamer's Haven at gamershavenpodcast.com and Vorpal Network at vorpalnetwork.com are proud to present coverage of Gen Con 2010.
It's game time.
Quiet, please. I am analyzing.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Is the next step the transplantation of the human brain?
Ballsy. Stupid, but ballsy.
Stand by for action.
Welcome to the party, pal!
Okay.
Remember, we're not dealing with an intelligence on our own level.
Bring in the logic probe!
Ooh!
End of line.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. Huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com. Or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
This is the Vorpal Network.
Fancy name, plays my... Don does. I'm Eric Mersman.
Write your name on the other side. They know who I am. All this stuff up.
I'm an attorney in Chicago. I work at a firm called Winston Strawn. I also do a lot of work with an organization called Lawyers for the Creative Arts. It's a pro bono organization. Mostly works in Illinois, but we do some work all over the country in representing all sorts of artists and in all sorts of fun ways. My practice focuses on IP litigation, intellectual property litigation, so the defamation stuff is not my primary specialty, but I know enough about it from my work with LCA and stuff that I hopefully can be useful to you. And then since this is like a lawyer topic spiel, I have to do the disclaimer that, like, I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer. I'm not actually giving you legal advice here. I can't answer any, like, really fact-specific questions, but I can hopefully help you understand what the right questions are to ask your own lawyer, or something like that.
Hopefully how to avoid having to ask a lawyer.
Yeah, that would be ideal.
Yeah, same kind of spiel, I guess. My name is Don Bingle. I am a gamer and author. I'm also an attorney, although I do not work in the intellectual property area. I'm a corporate securities guy, which is why Eric's going to do most of the talking here. And yes, my law firm requires me to say I'm not your lawyer, they're not your lawyer, I'm not giving legal advice, and please do not give me any confidential information.
So, with all that fun stuff in mind, let's jump into... defamation. Well, we're going to talk about a couple different things. The idea of this seminar is basically if I want to incorporate something real, like something based on a person or actual facts that happen in real life, what do I have to be worried about in putting that in my book or my movie or whatever creative work you plan to share with the public? Or actually, with defamation, it even applies to if you're going to share those facts with your next door neighbor in a lot of cases. The defamation and the privacy laws, they really vary from state to state and kind of the specific details. So again, like before you take anything I say as gospel, you should figure out what the deal is in your own locality. I know most about Illinois because that's where I took and passed the bar exam.
So will you be saying some of the laws for Illinois?
I'm going to try to keep everything on a level that's high enough to be pretty broadly applicable, but the only things that I can say that I am correct about are the Illinois laws, so
okay,
you should double check.
That's where I'm from, too, so I'm kind of interested.
Yeah.
And if you live outside your jurisdiction, you said, look, what would be a good way to find a group in our area, like your pro bono group, what would be the...
Well, the LCA actually works with people all across the country.
Okay, so what's the local chapter of that?
Yeah, the website is law-arts.org, I believe. You know, there are other organizations that I don't know off the top of my head, but they're definitely out there. So defamation used to be called slander and libel, right? That's like everybody's fun little cocktail facts that slander is oral and libel is written. But now it doesn't really exist anymore. It's just all kind of defamation. And what it boils down to is it's any communication that's, so it has to be A, a communication, B, it has to be derogatory, C, it has to be false, and D, it has to concern someone's reputation. That's kind of the dime version of definition of defamation. So communication just means anything that involves more than one person. So if you defamation, you don't have to announce it, from the rooftops. You can defame somebody just by picking up the phone and calling someone else. Derogatory means it's a fact, not an opinion. So you have to say a negative fact about someone, like, that person stole $5,000 from me, not that person is a cheat, or that person is not nice. And false, it has to be false. Now, this is kind of in flux right now. The old rule used to be it doesn't matter if you think it's true, it only matters if it's actually true. So even if you think it's true, if it turns out to be false and you're defaming this person, that spells trouble. It's kind of shifting. Well, it definitely shifted in terms of public figures. So if someone is a public figure, it requires what's called actual malice, which means you know that it's false or you are acting in reckless disregard of whether it's true or false. So, if you're just throwing around wild accusations, and you hear, say, well, I don't technically know that you are not a serial killer, so it's okay if I call you that. You probably should have known that the person was not, or you acted in reckless disregard of whether or not that was true or false. And it's kind of interesting, though, because this kind of ties in the false and derogatory thing. There are some sets of facts out there where a fact was so outlandish that no one would actually think that it was true, so therefore it wasn't false and derogatory. The classic one was a Hustler magazine called Jerry Falwell. It said that Jerry Falwell had slept with his own mother, and the court said that nobody actually thought that Hustler magazine was saying that you actually did that. They were just making fun of you, and he didn't win. And so the fourth thing is the reputation. Usually you have to show that it caused you personal damage in some way. And this is like once you're like actually in court and all of that. So obviously our goal is to never even get to that point. But it's good to know what happens once you're there so you can figure out how not to end up there. showing that it caused damage in some way. The exceptions are things that are so harmful that you don't have to show, and this also varies state by state. In Illinois, the categories are things that imply that you committed a crime, things that say that you are infected with a communicable disease of any kind that, if true, would tend to exclude you from society. Things talking about that you're bad at your job, and things that make it hard for you to perform your job. So, you know, even if, like, you could either say that I was a crappy lawyer, or that I would, which would be saying that I was bad at my job, or you could say that I'm a liar, which technically might still make me a pretty good lawyer, but maybe somebody wouldn't want to hire me, so it'd make it more difficult for me to practice as a lawyer. And there's a category in a lot of states, not in Illinois anymore, but that is imputing serious sexual misconduct. In some states, it just says imputing adultery. And in some states, that's restricted only towards women. So that's the fun state of these ancient laws. Similar to defamation is disparagement. And that's usually when you're talking about either a company's product or somebody's work product, something that an individual or a company is putting out in the course of their business, criticizing the quality of goods and services, reflects upon someone's integrity of business or profession. It's similar to defamation, but it can sometimes apply to companies too. This also gets into trademark a little bit, which we're going to talk about next hour, just a bit. So, but you know, the classic kind of cure-all for defamation is, as long as it's true, you're not defaming anyone. Like, once you get to court, which way does that go? I think it's actually it's their burden to demonstrate that it's false, usually. But ideally, right, like, if the point is to try to not get sued for defaming somebody, which is ideally, you know, you don't have to worry about proving or not proving. You're not proving anything until you're actually standing in front of a jury. So you never want to get to that point. So hopefully what you can do is you can either A, not use a real person, or B, not say anything that's false if you decide that you're going to use a real person. Yeah. Oh.
I was just going to say, you know, people will come up all the time to lawyers and say, you know, well, can somebody sue me if I do this? And the answer to that question is always yes. No matter, you know, can somebody sue me if I make them a birthday cake? Yes, they can. It costs $15 or $35 or whatever to file a complaint. It only takes one person to file it. They can sue you. Will they win? That's an entirely different question. And that's a question that may not be answered for years and after thousands and thousands of dollars. So your first goal is not to get sued. And so your first goal is to not do things that will encourage people to sue you. And then your second goal is that if they sue you, they lose.
Yeah.
If someone does sue you and they lose, but it was like brought out in the media, like one of those big stint things, can you sue them for defamation of character?
It really depends. There's there are a lot of different things that play into that. There's a certain privilege that goes along with anything that goes on in court. So just because the idea is that there's a vested interest in having open and open exchange in court proceedings.
Okay.
So you're kind of if somebody sits up in court and they swear on the Bible that the classic case, if that was the case, then anytime somebody brought
Well, any kind of civil suit, yeah. Really.
Quite frankly,
because of the limited privilege that is given for what is said in complaints and court filings, there is a certain technique by people who want to pressure other people to basically defame them in a complaint and say, oh, you know, they ripped me off, they're a bad business person, blah, 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 blah. And then they, you know, will call up the Tribune or whatever and say, you know, a really interesting suit was filed today. Yeah. You should go take a look at the court papers.
Well, or turn around and publish an article in their own trade magazine or...
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Based on the facts in the complaint. Well, you know, the facts are just what somebody says is true. But that's a way, it's a mechanism people use to hurt other people.
Okay.
I'm not encouraging you to do so.
So you're usually safe from getting accused of defamation if things are true, but unfortunately you're not out of the woods yet, because even true facts are occasionally protected by the law, and that gets us into the privacy side of things. So again, this privacy is another aspect of the law that varies a lot state to state. I'm going to talk about what I know about Illinois and what I know about Illinois that's pretty common state to state. You know, a lot of states have very similar laws, but they kind of vary in the details. So there are four kind of aspects of privacy in Illinois, and that's public disclosure of private facts, and false light. Those are the two that are most important to writers. There are also issues about appropriating somebody's name or likeness or the right to publicity, which is could be applicable, but mostly that comes into writers when you're maybe promoting a book or something of that nature. And intrusion upon seclusion, which is more an issue for photographers or filmmakers, but I'll still touch on it a little bit. So public disclosure of private facts means it's kind of the true side of defamation. So if you find out this, you know, burning secret that this person has, and you do go climb up on the mountaintops and shout it to the world, and it's highly offensive or embarrassing, then you expose yourself to this aspect. And the idea here is that these facts are so intimate that their disclosure to the public is deeply embarrassing to the person and is perceived as gratuitous by the community. So again, there's like the fun four-factor rule that to publicly disclose it, the facts have to be completely non-public, has to be highly offensive, and it's not of a legitimate public concern. And you also have to actually be talking about the person, I guess. That's important in a fiction writing context, especially because if you do happen to know this highly embarrassing fact about your cousin, and you write a talking guppy that happens to share that particular highly embarrassing private fact, unless your cousin's nickname is Guppy, you're hopefully have put enough space between your character and the actual person that your cousin might still be mad at you, might still yell at you, but you aren't the one that told that secret, because nobody else reading that book would say that is
that guy. They can't really go after you for something like that?
It has happened.
Did they win?
I'm sure somebody has won on a very similar character that...
Oh, there was the Miss America contestant. You remember that case?
Mm-hmm.
There was basically somebody came out with a book about basically sexual shenanigans behind the scenes at a Miss America type pageant. And the chief character was a Miss Wyoming, and a former Miss Montana, Miss America contestant, sued, saying that this character was clearly based on her. And, you know, it's kind of a weird thing because I'm not sure anybody would have thought of it if she hadn't sued. But it's kind of like, no, you know, she twirls a baton, I twirl a baton, she does this, you know, I do this, and this, and this. This is clearly all based in me, and then you said she's a slut, and I'm not a slut, and so please pay me millions of dollars. And that suit progressed for a number of years, and she was at least successful in the lower courts. I don't know what ultimately happened to it, but she was at least successful in the lower courts in establishing that the character was based on her and that she did not engage in all the deviant sexual activity that was alleged because the fictional character did. And so, yeah, that can be, it can be an issue.
Wow, that's scary.
And so I guess the flip side of that would be that that would apply to the privacy issue if she actually had committed all those deviant sexual acts, but nobody else knew about them. Yeah.
Now, what in the event that you don't actually have a direct knowledge of the specific individual and some guy out in the middle of nowhere says, well, this is, you know, clearly, you know, something that I've done that you, you know, managed to make up precisely, so you had to have somehow known me and this, that, and the other.
Yeah, you're definitely, I mean, you. I mean, again, the standby that anybody can sue anybody over anything, so if he's crazy enough and has a couple extra bucks, who knows? But
isn't that the kind of thing that would be have to be proven in court?
Yeah, eventually. For defamation, again, like if he's saying, you know, you implied all these things about me that aren't true, it would be very difficult for somebody to claim that you did that on purpose, not even knowing the person in the first place. I mean, that's kind of one of the underlying facts that has to go on here. Like, you would have needed to, like, for public disclosure of private facts, you would have needed to know the private facts in order for you to disclose them. Like, if you happen to write a character that, you know, is exactly like someone else and discloses their deepest, darkest secret to the world, but you have no idea that that person ever existed, this is just a one in a trillion chance, that you would be safe once you got to the courts on public disclosure of private facts because you didn't know the private fact that you were allegedly disclosing.
In some ways, this is similar to an issue of proof that can come up in copyright cases for music and in plagiarism instances. You know, like if I'm an unpublished author and big, you know, new successful book comes out that has similar characteristics to my book, you know, I suppose it's easy for me to sue and say, well, this big famous author ripped off my book. But the hard thing for me to prove in court is how the big name author ever had an opportunity to rip off my book. And so when you see these suits, it's kind of like, no, you know, I'm able to prove that this guy was in Memphis when my band was in Memphis and we played this song at a coffee club and he could have been there and he could have heard it and that's how he ripped it off. Or my agent's cousin my cousin's agent, whatever. You know, there's some relationship through somebody in the publishing industry who saw the unpublished manuscript, didn't buy it, and also saw the published manuscript and did buy it, and they're the connection that is how my great words of wizardry or whatever got to this other person. If you can't show that nexus, I think you got a really hard time in court because, you know, look, there are lots of things that end up being similar, and it's being able to prove that it's yours and protectable. Two things, yours and protectable, that is the important thing in those kinds of suits. And it's the same kind of thing for defamation. If you can't prove that nexus, I think you got a big problem.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that courts are moving away from that it doesn't matter if you think it's true, it only matters if it's actually true standard. Okay. Because courts have just said that time and time again that just imposes too much of a restriction on your speech. Like, you if you think it's actually true, then you are not defaming somebody.
I just realized I might be doing something really bad and advising people to do something really bad.
You're not a lawyer and you don't represent the other.
So you can give them as much bad advice as you want.
Well, I go to a convention with a notebook or to a park with a notebook, and I will sit down there and I will watch people because I put descriptions of people in my books, whether it's fantasy or modern day or whatever. Because I believe that real people just pop on the pages, especially if they're doing weird things like, you know, wiping their nose off on their, you know, I mean, I write down these gestures, I write down these things, and a lot of times I'm writing down things that are not complimentary, you know, just kind of sometimes disgusting things that people do, or the way they wear, or the way they talk. I like to take snippets of dialogue. Can these people come back at me because they look bad in a book and they think that I'm using them? And you know what? Yeah, I am using them. You know, I'll make changes, but...
Usually the level of similarity that has to exist between the real person and the fictional character is of a higher level than just kind of a couple details. It's the kind of thing where you pick up the book and you read it, and a reasonable person would say, I know this is about this. This is about this exact other person. Not, you know, this person has some similar characteristics. This person has, you know, likes to wear a red ball cap, and I like to wear a red ball cap, and he's wearing, gray gym shoes. I wear gray gym shoes, and he's running at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I run at 6 o'clock in the morning. And he's a murderer, and I'm not a murderer, so you're defaming me. That's, you know, that's pretty far removed. Now, if you get to the point where you're saying, you know, this guy is wearing a red ball cap, I wear a red ball cap, great gym shoes, I wear great gym shoes, running 6 o'clock in the morning, I run 6 o'clock in the morning, he's a lawyer in Chicago, practices intellectual property law, I'm a lawyer in Chicago, practices intellectual property law, his name is Derek Schmerschman, and my name is Eric Mersman. You know, once you get... much closer, that's when you have to be worried, when you're actually basing the substance of the character on this real person.
I don't do that, I just steal descriptions, so I'm safe here.
Yeah, nobody's saying don't write what you know, but...
But, you know, Gene, yeah, I'm a paranoid sort, you know, those t-shirts, you know, watch out or you'll end up in my novel. I will never wear one of those t-shirts, because I don't want anybody, whoever, you know, should bring a suit against me, to say that I do that, because, you know... I don't.
Steal descriptions of people.
And it's also the reason why a TV show like Law & Order has at the front end of every frickin' show, mm-hmm. you know, this is about fictional characters and not about any actual people. And it's kind of like, well, that's in some ways just kind of standard boilerplate disclaimer that you'll see on in the beginning of almost any book. But the reason they do it is, what is Law & Order? Ripped from the headlines.
Yeah.
And when you see it, it's kind of like it reminds you of some recent news story, but they almost always will mix it up so that it doesn't, at the end, track the headline story the way that it seemed to in the beginning. And that's also, I think, a deliberate effort of them not to hew too closely to the actual situation. They want to suck you in by being close to it, but then they want it to go in a different direction so they have less legal problems.
Yeah, although Law & Order is in the fortuitous position of only ripping off these very public figures, these very public events. So, it's more difficult to say that you're ripping off a public figure. You're safer in ripping off a public figure than you are in ripping off some random person, but in either way,
or going into a law review or something like that, reading up on it, go, oh yeah, good, let's use this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that Law and Order has a whole team of lawyers who sit there and they say, well, actually, we should probably make the guy. Well, I think there was actually an issue with Law and Order and what's his name? The guy, the Cubs fan who went to catch the he was on an episode of Law and Order, and they were saying, well, he's not necessarily a public figure because he was thrust into the public limelight. He's not, you know, he's not Paris Hilton or whatever. And so, you know, I think there was a closer issue there, and I'm sure they just ended up writing him a big check or something of that nature. But it's a fine line when you try to base a character in whole or in part on a real person, and especially if you're making them your axe killer or your
And it's, you know, I know you've noticed on television shows where, you know, they'll go down a grocery aisle and it's none of the, you know, it's not the real products, they're, you know, fruit circles instead of Fruit Loops or whatever, and you go, well, why are they doing that? And part of that is they don't want to provide free product placement. If you want your product on a show, they want you to pay for it. But the other part is that sometimes the products that you see are referred to in a derogatory manner, and they just don't want the headache from it. And so it's easier for them to avoid issues of product defamation if they don't use real product names.
Yeah.
But I would be better off, right, and a lot of other writers would be better off, instead of just taking a solid description of a really interesting person, take two descriptions and meld them.
That would definitely be safer. I you know, whether the first one really puts you in any real danger, you may or may not have, but certainly the picking and choosing discrete details is always safer than taking a whole real person and sticking them in your book.
And I only ask just because I write fiction, but I wrote a true crime book. And it was a departure because I had to be vetted, and they went over my manuscript with a fine-tooth comb because most of the people that I had used in my book were still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so the publisher was real concerned because I'll tell you, when you write a true crime book, you don't put these people in a good light. So.
Yeah. Well, and that actually have a couple benefits with something like that. One is that if you're publicly disclosing private facts, but they're newsworthy, or they're a matter of legitimate public concern, you have an advantage there because the First Amendment wins out over them wanting to keep their secret about, you know, them embezzling money from their government defense contracts secret. There is an issue where if you're not even talking about discrete facts, but you're talking about this overall false light, and that's kind of the next topic, is when you publicize true details, but in a context that conveys a misleading impression of the person's character. And that the Hornbook, classic Hornbook example of this was in Michael Moore's Roger and Me. He actually had a friend of his who was a prominent defense attorney, I think. He taped him at a big Great Gatsby, like, fancy dress party, talking about how great it was to live in Flint, Michigan, and, you know, how much he liked it, and took that picture and then juxtaposed it with these images of kind of the poverty of the shutdown factories, the people who have suffered from that, and made this guy who was actually a close friend of, well, was, I guess, a close friend of Moore's, was, you know, a philanthropist, a good guy, made him out to be this, you know, fat cat who was, you know, sitting on the backs of the poor while he sipped his mint julep. You know, that was a successful action. He won for false light. You know, the classic hypothetical example is you take a picture of a guy talking to a woman on a street corner, and that's all well and good. You know, that actually happened. They talked. It was in public. You put in a newspaper with a caption under it about the increase in prostitution in your city. and you've now painted those two people in a false light. They were really there, they were really talking, but the context in which you place it puts them in a false light.
Now, is the statute of limitation on copyright, does if someone dies, is that change things? I remember one book accusing Winston Churchill of masterminding the assassination of Michael Collins or something. Could the Winston Churchill estate sue that author?
I'm not 100% sure, but I think for these two categories, the public disclosure of private facts and false light, I don't think those pass on to the estate. Now, the next category, the appropriation of a name or likeness, the right to publicity, that one does. And that's saying, you know, if you, you know, put, there's actually a very recent case of this is, I don't know if anybody played Plants vs. Zombies. There's an enemy zombie in that game who moonwalks out, then spins around, and then four other zombies come around and they dance and kill your plants. While the estate of Michael Jackson has decided that is too similar, and I don't think they actually brought suit, but they asked them to take it down with a, I'm sure, a very long letter written by their attorneys, and they have. And if you now go and update your Plants vs. Zombie game, it will no longer feature such a similar zombie. And it prohibits the use of an identity for commercial purposes. So for promotions, in association with the product that you're selling. Now, what's interesting is like even if you're selling your book, if you have a famous person in your book, that's not a misappropriation of their right to publicity. There's a whole list of things in Illinois, at least, and a lot of other states, because this actually is a law that there was like a model law, and then all the states just kind of copied it. Not all of them, but yeah. And there's like a whole list of things that are not prohibited: news, public affairs, sports broadcasts, political campaigns, etc., etc. But one of them is books, articles, and now there's a case where there's, a book that didn't have anything to do with, they put a photograph on the cover of the book. The book didn't have anything to do with the photograph or the woman in the photograph. They just put it on the cover, for whatever reason. That was a commercial use. So it's decided as commercial use. Now, if the likeness reflects the free speech contained in the book, then it's not a commercial use. So it's kind of weird. The safest thing here is just to not use anyone famous who hasn't signed a big, long waiver to promote anything of yours. The last one is this intrusion upon seclusion. That just means you see something that you shouldn't have seen. So, like, you point your camera in somebody's living room window, and that's, you're intruding on their seclusion. You shouldn't do it. It doesn't have to necessarily be someone's living room window either. It's any unauthorized intrusion. It's highly offensive or objectionable, reveals a private matter, causes anguish and suffering. It's mostly about the context of the act that you're seeing. So it's not really that you, it's not about publishing. I'm just kind of bringing it up because it has to do with these privacy rules.
Before you change on that subject that you just covered there with the intrusion on seclusion, wouldn't that be protected by the viewable normally from the street type of thing?
Yes and no. I mean, it depends. Like, that's what gets into the kind of the private matter aspects of it and the unauthorized intrusion aspects of it. Like, there was even a case where a prisoner was in prison, was in a fenced off enclosure lifting weights. And he said that was, taping him there was still an unauthorized intrusion upon seclusion because he was private, like that was his private time, I guess, with the weights and the guards. But so the weird thing about intrusion upon seclusion, if you're filming a documentary or taking pictures, candid pictures of people for a photojournalism project, get everyone's permission. That's really the bottom line for that. It's kind of amorphous and it's tough to pin down. And that's really the bottom line for the whole defamation right to privacy thing is, if you want to base a character off of a real person, get permission. That's your safest bet. Yeah.
Where does satire fall in there?
Satire really doesn't apply too much to these categories. I guess you could kind of read into that defamation thing, like if it's so ridiculous, no one would actually think it's true. Mm-hmm. Satire really comes into play more with copyright and other intellectual properties.
Some issues. Mm-hmm. My favorite is on the parody issue. This is in the mid-70s. National Lampoon magazine actually did an ad which perfectly mimicked the style of and the copy, the font, everything of the then print Volkswagen ads. And the headline on the Volkswagen ad was, "If Teddy Kennedy driven a Volkswagen, he'd be president today." And then you get into the copy, and it's all kind of, how they're airtight. They're so airtight you have to roll down the window to close the door. And they float, not long enough, that you don't get wet, but long enough so you can get fully dressed and blah, 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 and on and on like that. Boom.
Fully dressed?
Did fully that dressed, in there? Yes. They got sued.
Duh.
Immediately. And action for injunction.
Sued by who? I don't know.
That was the curious thing. Not by Mary Jo Pecknie, not by Ted Kennedy, or Mary Jo Pecknie's estate. By Volkswagen. By Volkswagen. Because, Volkswagen wanted no association whatsoever with it. And their argument was, you're causing us business commercial harm by making people think that this is a real ad that we pull out. And by the way, I originally saw it not in the context of the magazine. Somebody put it up in their dorm door. I thought it was real. I really did. And $6 million pulled the magazine from the market. If you got that magazine with that ad, that's a collector's item. I did. So.
But yeah, and probably they just sued under a defamation, kind of defamation of their product, or maybe even trademark. And yeah.
How about the use of historical figures in fiction? Can you use, Winston Churchill? Maybe his estate would go after you, but you could use Caesar. Nobody can go against you.
Right. I mean, usually the long-dead historical figures are pretty much fair game for you wanting to, defame or disclose their private facts. There's not a, the exception would be if it was an estate that carried on continuous business, the estate of Michael Jackson. They're still selling records, Michael Jackson records, and so if you say something horrible about him, you could actually, and in that case, you probably wouldn't even get sued by the estate. You get sued by, Michael Jackson Records Incorporated, or what have you. But
the same thing with Tolkien.
Yeah.
Tolkien sues people for using the, trying to copy something in a movie or something like that.
Right, well, and that comes back into copyright, which is a little different, and that does last forever and forever until Mickey Mouse dies. And, actually just talking just about the person, a real historical person, you're usually pretty safe there.
And a lot of the people that you're going to want to use, those are going to be public figures.
Yeah.
I will say too, Eric's talking about Illinois law and all of that. One of the things that has happened over the last several years on these defamation suits is that the law of England puts the burden of proof on the author rather than on the person suing, and so people who can't successfully sue here will sue in England and base it on the fact that 35 copies of their book that was published in the U.S. made their way to England, and they can prove that. And suddenly then there's an action in England where where the poor author has a lot more expense because he has to prove that it isn't defamation. And actually, that's a big enough deal that, and then there have been some huge judgments granted in the English courts that the Congress has said now that they won't enforce them. And there's a big effort to get the United Kingdom in line with the rest of the Western world on standards of defamation.
So, Officer Bill Willing in the Fables might be a question for next hour, but one thing with the piracy, there's a scene where the wooden soldiers in suits with guns walking down the street of New York, and there's you've got a couple in the in an apartment window, and they're going, "Well, who's marching today?" Well, they've got guns and suits. Is it the Young Republicans? No, well, it could be the Nazis taking Paris. And I would think the RNC would be one of those corporations that would have a trigger happy on the lawyer thing or something. But that appears to have passed. What was it? Just because it was a side character. A thought of that, and obviously these things were not Young Republicans at all, but just in a character's mind resembles them.
You've got a lot of leeway in the political field, and the Republican Party knows that, and by the way, probably thinks pretty highly of free speech anyhow. So,
sure.
In the political field, people say all sorts of things about candidates. And especially at the national level.
So groups of candidates are a little more fair game than anything
that you can characterize as political speech, courts are pretty quick to defend it, and people aren't going to really pick those fights. People in politics aren't going to pick those fights.
It's a stupid fight to pick, and it's a fight that they're going to lose, so they'll just stay away from it.
Okay. I just come from a state where the governor thought who was convicted of a drug crime in his youth, when to just bring that up was the most evil smear attack on him at all, and the press said, "Oops," and didn't do a thing about it.
Well, you know, it is politics. You know, you can say it's a smear, and it may be a smear, and you know, the press may react one way or another, or the public may react one way or the other, but that really doesn't have a lot to do with the standards of defamation.
Okay, so. Yeah, okay.
Was there another question?
No. Well, I was just wondering, so if the burden of proof is on the author in England, so if you use a name, if you know a lot of people and you're writing a character, even if it doesn't resemble the character, but you use someone's name, who's like one of your friends, can they come after you at all?
Well, first of all, I recommend against it. I recommend against using the names of real people you know in stories. Nothing good can come of it.
Using friends.
Now, look.
It just gets hard when it's like, the 100 most common names, I know people with those names.
Well, yeah, but using the name Bob is different than using the name, you know, Robert J. Alexander III, and your friend is, you know, Robert J. Alexander III. Sure, there are common names. And one of the, you know, there are two theories on this, I guess, in authors. One is, you know, you write the book, you don't worry about the names, you make up the names you want to make, and then before you send the thing off to the publisher, you take every name and you do a Google search. And some people are looking for no Google hits. And some people are looking for 10,000 Google hits. Because if there's 10,000 people with that name, the chances are that, one, it's a common name, and two, that, you know, no individual person of those 10,000 people is going to be able to say, you stole my name, you know, and that was obviously me you were talking about. Mm-hmm. I don't actually go either direction. I mostly go to make sure I haven't done something stupid, like use the name of a NHL player, which I wouldn't know because I don't care about the NHL, and it's just the name I made up, and it happens to match. You know, I was recently trying to resell a reprint, a short story that I had about a guy talking with his minister about discovery of alien life, right? And the Iowa farmer's name that I used was Randy Jackson. And I was rereading the story before I sent it out. I said, ooh, Randy Jackson, you know, American Idol. Wow. And so I actually got on Google and I looked up and it's like, well, thank heavens I wrote that story before American Idol was on the television, or I would look really stupid. Even though Randy Jackson, pretty common name. You know, if I wrote that story now, I would not use that name because he is too famous, and people would think that I'd gotten it there and the character had, you know, nothing to do with him, and it would just be a distraction. And I actually have thought about if I ever do sell it for reprint rights, I may just change the character's name because people will associate it now in a way that they didn't when I originally wrote it.
As long as you don't use Michael Jackson.
There you go.
So yeah, any other questions? That's pretty much all I had. You know, the bottom line is if you're going to use a real person, get permission. If you can't get permission, you absolutely want to base a character off of a real person. You want to make sure that the character is sufficiently obscured that you would require independent knowledge to make the connection between the character and the person. You want to make sure you're not using private facts. And you want to make sure you don't use that character's likeness to advertise the book. Those are kind of your three big keys. That's still not going to, you know, that doesn't give you a bulletproof vest against being sued, but it helps you protect yourself a little bit, and it will give you the information you need to talk to your lawyer to figure out if what's in your book is okay or not. Because the other thing is, if you are handing your book off to a publisher or an editor or whoever, they're not going to necessarily know, hey, this side character is based on my cousin. And so no one that clears the rights on your book, no one that that takes some of the risk too on your book is going to know necessarily that there's a little, that there's the potential for exposure there. So I'm going to make sure that you're asking the right questions to the people who can give you the right answers.
Are you saying if you are going to use, you know, somebody's likeness, like for a photojournalist project, you obviously want to get these permissions in writing of some form, mm-hmm. to document the event that something goes south and you wind up in suit. What would you need, or where would you go, or how would you procure some kind of legal verbiage to put on this form that they're going to have to sign?
I know that that's something that the LCA, the Lawyers for Creative Arts, does all the time, okay. because they always send me emails about their pro bono projects that they want me to work on. Not just me, I'm not like the star lawyer for the LCA, but they send them around, and one of them is, you know, helping a documentary filmmaker with securing rights and things like that, so they can help you. I'm sure that there are resources online that just have form
releases.
Yeah, releases. I don't know which ones are solid and which ones aren't, but
you know, the other way that sometimes people try to secure that permission in areas where there are controlled environments. You know, you go to Disney World sometimes and you'll see a little placard out at the front and it says, you know, we've got film crews filming commercials today, and by coming into the park, you agree that your image can be used in connection with all our promotional materials. And I'm sure that they take a picture of that. People are pointing it out. It's on the back of your badge.
So you use his or her name, voice, likeness, and all reproductions thereof by any means and in all media now and hereafter known, including without limitation the internet, for all purposes worldwide in perpetuity.
Controlled events. So, you know, yes, when you're, you know, half naked on stage in the costume contest, yeah, can that get put on the net? Yes, it can by then.
That's why I was wondering, because they told me that I can take whatever pictures I want of the seminars and people in the audience, put on the web page promoting next year's writers' symposium because they're covering them.
Yeah.
And I'm not making financial gain by doing so. So I'm safe in doing this, correct?
If that's what they tell you. I would assume if they say that it's okay.
Yeah.
What's that?
It's on the back of the
yeah.
But I also think that you would begin to be in questionable territory if you were then to take one of those photos that you took of the writer's group and say, you know, Eric Mersman recommends Zombie versus Plants for role-playing game. Because then you are, one, using his likeness for commercial gain, and two, maybe putting words in his mouth and in a commercial setting. That's not a defamation issue, but it's a likeness issue.
Most people who come to Gen Con and get these badges don't read the badge and don't know that they're being approved.
I've got a whole short story based on fine print,
and what people, what rights people give up in fine print. So,
yes, at the last one of these that I was at was to a group of lawyers. It was for like a CLE thing. So it was all lawyers who worked in privacy. Like this is what they do. When you go to visit I know when I go to visit like my scientific clients, when you walk in the door, you just have to sign in something, and that we asked the group, like, how many of you have done this? You know, everyone raised their hand. How many of you have actually read that? None of them. Like, none of them in this room of 50 lawyers had ever read what they're actually signing before they, you know, signed into the building. And if you look on those things, like, it's pretty great, especially from an intellectual property point of view, because you're walking into these science labs, and so you're saying, like, not only am I not going to take anything, but anything that I come up with while I'm visiting your company belongs to you, the company. And so here you have this room full of IP privacy lawyers who had all, you know, unbeknownst to them, signed away all their rights to whatever brilliant ideas popped into their head during those 2 hours while they were visiting their client.
The same thing happens in technical business. Unless if you think of something, wouldn't it be great if we had this software that did, you have no rights to it.
The question that goes back to the stuff you talked about earlier. When I was a newspaper reporter, I wrote a story about a county jailer who was forcing female inmates to have sex with him. Because one of the female inmates, after she got out, talked to me, and so we did this story. I did not mention her name. I mentioned his name, and there it is above the banner, you know, top of page one, and this went on for a couple of issues. He was upset.
And you think?
he threatened to kill me. Obviously, that didn't work.
It's your story
for
page.
He didn't threaten to sue me, but he was kind of stupid.
That was going to be his backup plan. Killing you. Didn't shut you up.
But I cost him the next election. I mean, because one would assume that this getting public cost him the next election. But you say what's private? I mean, him having sex with the inmates in the jail. You know, that's a pretty private setting, and the public.
But that's a public place.
No, it's a public location.
Well, but the key thing here, I think the key thing here is actually, well, A, that's news reporting. News reporting has a much wider bubble of protection around it because of the First Amendment. And two, it's a matter of public interest. Like, the public needs to know that things like that are going on. And so that really, at that point, once you're talking about news reporting, once you're talking about reporting on, backdoor dealings of public figures, there's a very few, of course they can threaten to sue, but that's exactly what the law is set up to exclude from public disclosure of private facts are things exactly like that.
Okay.
As long as it's factual.
Yeah, if you're wrong.
Or as long as she has reasonable belief that it's factual and wasn't reckless in her research.
Well, yeah. You never said it wasn't true.
Maybe that's what cost.
Now, if your source is like, he took me in a room, and you're like, and he did what? Like, and you're filling in the blanks, you're pushing it, you're making up the story, then
I know. Any blanks.
that's when you get into this category of a possible issue with defamation, but the set of facts that you share with us doesn't even come close. So
we're officially out of time.
Yeah, it looks like we're ready to make the transition. Mm-hmm.
paying attention now?
Yes.
All right. Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone, where we don't know what we're talking
about. Hey, we do know what we're talking about. You know, we called the whole Hugo Weaving Red Skull thing, remember?
Oh, right. Fine. Where was it? The Red Phone Zone, where we talk about all kinds of gaggles.
Aaron, could you cut it with the gaggles thing? It's not working for me.
All right, fine. The Red Phone Zone, where we talk about movies, comics, video games. Hey,
don't forget that we talk about, you know, Bruce Campbell and Christopher Lee, obviously.
Natalie Portman.
All right, guys, I'm trying to do a commercial for the Red Phone Zone, where we talk about movies, comics, video games, tabletop gaming, all kinds of other geek stuff.
You mean that show we broadcast on Ustream?
Yes.
Wednesday, 8 Central Standard Time.
Right, at redphonezone.com. Now, can you guys just give me a minute to get this promo done?
Sure. Sorry, dude.
Yeah.
All right, from the top. Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone.
Aaron, we need a tiebreaker. Okay, who would win in a fight with Galactus?
Anti-Monitor.
Galactus and Anti-Monitor. Come on.
I think the more important question would be who would win in a fight between me and you two idiots.
Well, I guess we don't know what we're talking about.
You've been listening to the Gamers Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free, 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.